Chapter 11. The Rescue. Our first night at the whaling station was blissful. Crean and I shared a beautiful room in Mr. Sawler's house, with electric light and two beds, warm and soft. We were so comfortable that we were unable to sleep. Late at night a steward brought us tea, bread and butter, and cakes, and we lay in bed reveling in the luxury of it all. Outside, a dense snowstorm, which started 2 hours after our arrival and lasted until the following day, was swirling and driving about the mountain slopes. We were thankful indeed that we had made a place of safety, for it would have gone hard with us if we had been out on the mountains that night. Deep snow lay everywhere when we got up the following morning. After breakfast, Mr. Sawler took us around to Huvik in a motor launch. We were listening avidly to his account of the war and of all that had happened while we were out of the world of men. We were like men arisen from the dead to a world gone mad. Our minds accustomed themselves gradually to the tales of nations in arms, of deathless courage and unimagined slaughter, of a world conflict that had grown beyond all conceptions, of vast red battlefields in grimmest contrast with the frigid whiteness we had left behind us. The reader may not realize quite how difficult it was for us to envisage nearly 2 years of the most stupendous war of history. The locking of the armies in the trenches, the sinking of the Lusitania, the murder of Nurse Cavell, the use of poison gas and liquid fire, the submarine warfare, the Gallipoli campaign, the 100 other incidents of the war almost stunned us at first. And then our minds began to compass the train of events and develop a perspective. I suppose our experience was unique. No other civilized men could have been as blankly ignorant of world-shaking happenings as we were when we reached Stromness whaling station. I heard the first rumor of the Aurora's misadventures in the Ross Sea from Mr. Sorler. Our host could tell me very little. He had been informed that the Aurora had broken away from winter quarters in McMurdo Sound and reached New Zealand after a long drift, and that there was no news of the shore party. His information was indefinite as to details, and I had to wait until I reached the Falkland Islands some time later before getting a definite report concerning the Aurora. The rumour that had reached South Georgia, however, made it more than ever important that I should bring out the rest of the Weddell Sea party quickly, so as to free myself for whatever effort was required on the Ross Sea side. When we reached Huvik that Sunday morning, we were warmly greeted by the magistrate, Mr. Bernston, whom I knew of old, and the other members of the little community. Moored in the harbour was one of the largest of the whalers, the Southern Sky, owned by an English company but now laid up for the winter. I had no means of getting into communication with the owners without dangerous delay, and on my accepting all responsibility, Mr. Bernston made arrangements for me to take this ship down to Elephant Island. I wrote out an agreement with Lloyd's for the insurance of the ship. Captain Tom, an old friend of the expedition, happened to be in Huvik with his ship, the Orwell, loading oil for use in Britain's munition works, and he at once volunteered to come with us in any capacity. I asked him to come as captain of the Southern Sky. There was no difficulty about getting a crew. The whalers were eager to assist in the rescue of men in distress. They started work that Sunday to prepare and stow the ship. Parts of the engine were ashore, but willing hands made light labour. I purchased from the station stores all the stores and equipment required, including special comforts for the men we hoped to rescue, and by Tuesday morning the Southern Sky was ready to sail. I feel it is my duty, as well as my pleasure, to thank here the Norwegian whalers of South Georgia for the sympathetic hands they stretched out to us in our need. Among memories of kindness received in many lands sundered by the seas, the recollection of the hospitality and help given to me in South Georgia ranks high. There is a brotherhood of the sea. The men who go down to the sea in ships, serving and suffering, fighting their endless battle against the caprice of wind and ocean, bring into their own horizons the perils and troubles of their brother sailormen. The Southern Sky was ready on Tuesday morning, and at 9 o'clock we steamed out of the bay, while the whistles of the whaling station sounded a friendly farewell. We had foregathered aboard Captain Tom's ship on the Monday night with several whaling captains who were bringing up their sons to their own profession. They were old stagers, with faces lined and seamed by the storms of half a century, and they were even more interested in the story of our voyage from Elephant Island than the younger generation was. They congratulated us on having accomplished a remarkable boat journey. I do not wish to belittle our success with the pride that apes humility. Under Providence we had overcome great difficulties and dangers, and it was pleasant to tell the tale to men who knew those sullen and treacherous southern seas. McCarthy, McNeish, and Vincent had been landed on the Monday afternoon. They were already showing some signs of increasing strength under a regimen of warm quarters and abundant food. The carpenter looked woefully thin after he had emerged from a bath. He must have worn a lot of clothes when he landed from the boat, and I did not realize how he had wasted till I saw him washed and changed. He was a man over 50 years of age, and the strain had told upon him more than upon the rest of us. The rescue came just in time for him. The early part of the voyage down to Elephant Island in the southern sky was uneventful. At noon on Tuesday, May 23rd, we were at sea and steaming at 10 knots on a southwesterly course. We made good progress, but the temperature fell very low, and the signs gave me some cause for anxiety as to the probability of encountering ice. On the third night out, the sea seemed to grow silent. I looked over the side and saw a thin film of ice. The sea was freezing around us, and the ice gradually grew thicker, reducing our speed to about 5 knots. Then lumps of old pack began to appear among the new ice. I realized that an advance through pack ice was out of the question. The Southern Sky was a steel-built steamer, and her structure, while strong to resist the waves, could not endure the blows of masses of ice. So I took the ship north, and at daylight on Friday we got clear of the pancake ice. We skirted westward, awaiting favorable conditions. The morning of the 28th was dull and overcast, with little wind. Again the ship's head was turned to the southwest, but at 3 p.m. a definite line of pack showed up on the horizon. We were about 70 miles from Elephant Island, but there was no possibility of taking the steamer through the ice that barred the way. Northwest again we turned. We were directly north of the island on the following day, and I made another move south. Heavy pack formed an impenetrable barrier. To admit failure at this stage was hard, but the facts had to be faced. The southern sky could not enter ice of even moderate thickness. The season was late, and we could not be sure that the ice would open for many months, though my opinion was that the pack would not become fast in that quarter even in the winter, owing to the strong winds and currents. The southern sky could carry coal for 10 days only, and we had been out 6 days. We were 500 miles from the Falkland Islands and about 600 miles from South Georgia. So I determined that, since we could not wait about for an opening, I would proceed to the Falklands, get a more suitable vessel, either locally or from England, and make a second attempt to reach Elephant Island from that point. We encountered very bad weather on the way up, but in the early afternoon of May 31st we arrived at Port Stanley, where the cable provided a link with the outer world. The harbour master came out to meet us, and after we had dropped anchor I went ashore and met the governor, Mr. Douglas Young. He offered me his assistance at once. He telephoned to Mr. Harding, the manager of the Falkland Island station, and I learned, to my keen regret, that no ship of the type required was available at the islands. That evening I cabled to London a message to His Majesty the King, the first account of the loss of the Endurance and the subsequent adventures of the expedition. The next day I received the following message from the King. Rejoiced to hear of your safe arrival in the Falkland Islands, and trust your comrades on Elephant Island may soon be rescued. George R. I. The events of the days that followed our arrival at the Falkland Islands I will not attempt to describe in detail. My mind was bent upon the rescue of the party on Elephant Island at the earliest possible moment. Winter was advancing, and I was fully conscious that the lives of some of my comrades might be the price of unnecessary delay. A proposal had been made to send a relief ship from England, but she could not reach the southern seas for many weeks. In the meantime, I got into communication with the governments of the South American republics by wireless and cable, and asked if they had any suitable ship I could use for a rescue. I wanted a wooden ship, capable of pushing into loose ice, with fair speed and a reasonable coal capacity. Messages of congratulation and goodwill were reaching me from all parts of the world, and the kindness of hundreds of friends in many lands was a very real comfort in a time of anxiety and stress. The British Admiralty informed me that no suitable vessel was available in England, and that no relief could be expected before October. I replied that October would be too late. Then the British minister in Montevideo telegraphed me regarding a trawler named Instituto de Pesca No. 1, belonging to the Uruguayan government.